The top story is the number of people who have died in floods in Western Europe rises to at least 126. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa says the deadly unrest in his country over the past week was planned in advance. Also ahead, Afghan officials say government forces have launched an operation to retake a major border crossing with Pakistan from Taliban militants. Welcome to the program. Our top story, at least 126 people have been killed in torrential rains and flooding in Western Europe. The death toll from flash floods in Western Germany rose to 103, with more than 1,300 people missing. Officials in two states of North Rhine-Westphalia and Rhineland-Palatinate warned that the number could go up. The situation remains difficult to assess. President Frank-Walter Steinmeier has expressed shock at the extent of damage, highlighting that it was time to battle climate change. Germany is the worst affected by the ongoing flooding in Western Europe. Belgium has also confirmed at least 23 deaths. Meanwhile, Luxembourg and the Netherlands have evacuated thousands of people. More heavy rain is forecast across the region, with experts blaming climate change for the floods. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa says the deadly unrest in his country over the past week was planned in advance.
And it's quite clear that this, all these incidents of unrest and looting were instigated. There are instigators. There were people who planned it. They coordinated it.
Ramaphosa expressed concern over rising racial tensions in some parts of the country. He said his government would not allow anarchy and mayhem to prevail. The South African president was speaking to media as he visited the KwaZulu-Natal province. That is one of the worst hit areas in the unrest. The violence broke out after former President Jacob Zuma began his 15-month jail term for refusing to appear at a corruption inquiry. Officials say 117 people were killed and more than 1,700 arrested. They also say a dozen suspects have been identified in connection with the violence. Afghan officials say government forces have launched an operation to retake a key border crossing with Pakistan from Taliban militants. Heavy fighting is going on in the Spin-Boldak border crossing as Taliban insurgents have reportedly taken shelter in civilian homes. The border point provides direct access to Pakistan's Balochistan province. That is where the Taliban's top leadership has been based for decades now. The crossing fell to the Taliban earlier this week. The militant group has also captured Afghan border crossings with Iran and Turkmenistan. They stepped up their attacks in May, taking control of a swath of territories in Afghanistan. The military has pledged to retake all those areas. Our correspondent, Amin Alemi, quotes Afghan authorities as saying that the military has regained control of some territories captured by the Taliban.
The Afghan government officials here in Afghanistan's defense ministry says that Afghan military forces have retaken the control over some of key districts, mainly in northern and southern parts of Afghanistan. One of those key districts and areas is Spin-Boldak, that connects southern Kandahar province to neighboring Pakistan. Spin-Boldak is also home to the former police commander of Kandahar province, who was well known for his anti-Taliban stances. After capturing this area, I mean Spin-Boldak, the Taliban militants also entered the house of this former Kandahar police chief and burnt all of what were inside this house. In the meantime, the Taliban spokesman also says that they have gained major achievements not only in Spin-Boldak but also in Wish, that is the main border point between Pakistan and Afghanistan in the southern parts of southern part of this country. On the other hand, the Afghan government officials say that Afghan military forces have retaken Chakhansur district from the Taliban militants located in western Nimruz province, southern Nimruz province of Afghanistan.
Lebanon's political crisis deepens after Prime Minister-designate Saad al-Hariri failed to form a new government and announced his resignation. Hariri stepped down on Thursday after a meeting with President Michel Aoun. He has accused Aoun of hampering the process of forming a new government. Hariri told Lebanese media that he would be unable to run the country with a cabinet that Aoun wants. In response, the president's office said Hariri was not ready to discuss any kind of amendments to his proposed cabinet. Meanwhile, protests have broken out in the capital, Beirut, where protesters clashed with security forces. A number of people were injured. Lebanon's last government was forced to resign, if you recall, last August after that deadly explosion in Beirut. The country is also facing an economic crisis. Israel's new prime minister, Naftali Bennett, has relaunched a controversial project to construct over 3,400 settler units in the occupied West Bank. The so-called E1 project involves construction of the units at an area where hundreds of Palestinians live in Bedouin communities. Mona Kandil is in West Bank.
Israel has advanced a major settler building project known as E1. Israel's new prime minister, Naftali Bennett, has relaunched the controversial project for the construction of over 3,412 settler units in the occupied West Bank to connect the largest Israeli settlement of Ma'ale Adumim to the West Jerusalem Al-Quds. The project was first pushed forward by former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Palestinians have slammed the move as seriously dangerous.
Now, as Bennett brings it on the table, it is just to show the settlers that he's better than Netanyahu. He's continued the main strategy and the ideology of the settlements in the West Bank. Netanyahu has been freezing or a little bit slowed down the working in the E1, but they are now pushing it forward. This is a very dangerous colonial project in the West Bank. This will be totally cut off and divided the West Bank between the north and the south. So it's very sensitive, very strategic.
Israeli authorities have been seeking to expel tens of thousands of Palestinian Bedouins to other Palestinian towns since long time ago because the area has been allocated to E1 settlement constructions. This area sits on roughly 15 square kilometers of land northeast of Jerusalem Al-Quds. For years, the Israeli regime has tried to dismantle the Bedouin communities to make way for its massive E1 settlement project in East Jerusalem Al-Quds. The planned Israeli building in E1 would effectively cut the West Bank in half and prevent Palestinian sovereign contiguity between northern and southern West Bank.
The project comes in line with Israel's annexation plan. The new regime in Israel is seeking to disrupt any territorial integrity of a future Palestinian state based on the 1967 borders. To this end, it displaces more Palestinians in violation of all international laws.
Palestinians say that it's very clear that Bennett is even worse than Netanyahu, as he started rapidly to carry out his agenda to expand illegal settlements in the occupied territories even more vigorously. During Netanyahu's term in office, Israeli-only roads were built as first step in constructing settlements in the controversial E1 zone. Now Bennett has revived the plan and the actual construction for E1. Palestinians warned this project would practically cut the occupied West Bank in half. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
The United Arab Emirates is moving closer to Israel despite widespread calls to reconsider its policy toward the regime. Economic considerations are largely at play when it comes to the controversial détente.
The United Arab Emirates is among a group of Arab states that have normalized ties with the Israeli regime as part of a controversial initiative brokered by the United States and condemned by Palestinians. The Emiratis, who have been particularly open about their ongoing normalization process, opened an embassy in Israel this week.
The UAE has never been known for having an independent foreign policy. It has never stood for the rights of Palestinian people. Historically and recently, as you have seen, the UAE has always aligned its foreign policy with the foreign policy objectives of Western countries like the US and UK.
The new embassy is located in the heart of Israel's financial hub, Tel Aviv Stock Exchange Building. This is seen by many as a sign that the two sides are highlighting the role of economic cooperation in their normalization of ties. Last month, Israel opened an embassy in the Emirati capital, Abu Dhabi, and a consulate in the UAE's business hub, Dubai. Over the past year, the two sides have signed many deals, ranging from financial services to tourism. Critics say Emirati leaders have totally abandoned the Palestinian cause for the economic and political dividends of ties with the Israeli regime. The controversial normalization process is very much ongoing, despite Palestinian anger. Palestinians are outraged by the normalization, which they believe is threatening their planned statehood. The stances adopted by these Arab governments seem to be helping the Israeli regime to move out of deep isolation in the West Asia region. Palestinians say those Arab states are stabbing them in the back.
Several Palestinian factions have condemned the UAE's opening of its embassy in Tel Aviv. Resistance movement Hamas warned that the move presents a dangerous decline in Emirati politics, which would further embolden the occupying regime.
Palestinian movement Hamas says this week's embassy opening, quote, marks an insistence on the great sin against the people of Palestine and all the nations of the region. It warned that the move would encourage the regime to press ahead with its crimes in the occupied territories and in the besieged Gaza Strip. Observers warn that the embassy opening, just weeks after Israel's deadly onslaught against the Gaza Strip and the escalation of the regime's violations in the occupied West Bank, indicates that some Arab states are no longer bound by the Palestinian cause. Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against the Israeli occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today, as several Arab states are undermining the Palestinian cause by moving closer to Israel. The Palestinian issue was once a unifying cause among Arab countries. But Israel, backed by the United States, has apparently managed to divide them more than ever. Israel has been especially thankful to the United States for pushing the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan to normalize their ties with the regime. America has always been a staunch ally of Israel, but former U.S. President Donald Trump was perhaps the best friend of the Israelis in a very long time. His extremely pro-Israel decisions and policies are still impacting the lives of people in the West Asia region, especially those in Palestine. The Palestinians say they have come to the conclusion that America's heavily biased stance leaves no room for any further U.S. mediation role regarding Palestine in the future.
A disturbing case study released by British Muslim advocacy group CAGE has exposed British education system, which has been receiving quote-unquote diktats, to punishing students who express pro-Palestine views. The findings also reveal that a number of students have been either suspended or referred to anti-terrorism watchdogs simply for wanting to vocally defend Palestine during Israeli attacks on Gaza. Robert Carter has a report from London.
Accusations of a state-led anti-Palestine crackdown in British schools have been proven true following the release of a case study by Muslim advocacy group CAGE, which details not only the shocking treatment of students who expressed their humanitarian support for Palestine during Israel's recent onslaught, but also that school leaders have received diktats from the government.
These shock findings highlight the extent in which the government seems to be prepared to go in order to stamp out criticism of Israel at every avenue. Even young students are being targeted by the scheme, which appears bent on hampering freedom of speech on this particular issue.
Out of the 47 cases documented, censorship tactics included verbal warnings, suspensions, a student being expelled, and even police intervention and a referral to an anti-terrorism agency. While most of the students' activities involves little more than vocalizing support for Palestine, fundraising, and displaying Palestine flags. CAGE representatives expressed great concern at the toxic influence government watchdogs have in the British education system.
The schools happily endorse and welcome expressions of support for the Black Lives Matter movement. They join in campaigns against Islamophobia, against any sort of racism that exists in society and prejudices. But when it comes to issues of Palestine, it's as though they are blindsided, and they very much become extensions of the policing arm of the state. Schools and school leaders have a duty to foster an environment within their schools that is conducive to civic education, and to create students which are active citizens in the future. What schools should not be doing is disciplining students for practicing basic empathy and showing solidarity with oppressed people around the globe.
For adult activists, speaking up for Palestine could see your reputation assassinated. But now, even young, aspiring humanitarians could see their futures dashed simply for speaking out. Robert Carter, London.
At least 9 people, including a congresswoman, have been arrested during a voting rights protest in the U.S. Capitol of Washington, D.C. Democrat Joyce Beatty and the rest were arrested on Thursday afternoon. They protested to call on the Senate to pass a key bill that is part of election reforms Democrats are pushing for. The bill passed the House in March, but it's been held in the Senate because of a Republican filibuster. Representative Beatty and other protesters entered the Hart Senate office building, chanting, quote-unquote, end the filibuster. U.S. Capitol Police said they arrived at the scene after, quote, reports of illegal demonstration activity. They said those refusing to stop were arrested.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
June 28, 2021, on the occasion of the National Judiciary Week and the martyrdom anniversary of Ayatollah Martyr Beheshti and other personalities. Another point is the discussion of fighting corruption within the branch. This has also started in the branch. It is one of the most important endeavors. It is one of the first and foremost tasks of the judiciary. Of course, I would like to add that sometimes the controversy over the existence of corruption in the judiciary becomes so extreme that even honest, clean, and pious judges are insulted. This is not permissible. The vast majority of judges across the country are honorable, motivated, faithful, uncorrupted, and forgiving people. They are living a hard life and are doing heavy work. We should be careful not to be unkind to them. We should not be unkind to those, which should not be unkind to these pious individuals, who are undoubtedly the majority in the judiciary. But after all, the corrupt elements, no matter how small in numbers they are, exert their impact. In other words, if an average person in a public prosecutor's office or in such and such a court of law does a wrong and corrupt move, and if someone else is notified of it, they might spread it here and there, and subsequently the rumor mill will have it that there is corruption in the judiciary branch. There is only one corrupt person, but the judiciary branch will receive bad publicity. Therefore, your organization should seriously confront this issue so that honorable and pious judges are not insulted and disrespected. However, you should confront, in the true sense of the word, those who should be confronted. Well, we receive many popular reports. Every day, one or two briefings of popular reports and the like are given to me, and I study most of them. There are complaints that we often send to the judiciary. Sometimes it is complained that, for example, a certain financial culprit colludes with a person within a court in a certain city, and that they are accomplices. I sometimes receive such reports. Well, it may be true, it may be a lie, but it matters anyway. This is one of those conditions where you should immediately send the investigation team to investigate as soon as you receive report like this. This is one of those issues which should not be looked at with optimism.
Ministry.
By escalating raids against the resistance factions, the United States of America is venturing to tilt the Iraqi position decisively towards the demand for a complete American withdrawal, as well as providing a strong incentive for the factions to escalate in return. The pace of escalation is rising day after day against American interests in Iraq at a time when Mustafa al-Qadhimi's government is preparing to start the fourth round of the strategic dialogue, which will discuss a complete withdrawal of the American occupation forces instead of scheduling the withdrawal as agreed upon in the third round held last April. This shift in the Iraqi position came against the backdrop of the exchange of bombings between the Americans and the resistance factions, which began from mid-June and reached the 28th of June, when an American raid targeted a camp belonging to the Popular Mobilization Forces on the border strip between Syria and Iraq. The raids of the American occupation come to save Washington's face, especially after the repeated attacks that confused the Biden administration, in addition to the security and military losses suffered by his troops. It is now clear that the purpose of the Americans' continued escalation is to drag the Iraqi factions into an all-out war inside Baghdad and then in areas south of Iraq to create internal chaos. It's worth noting that since Biden took office at the beginning of this year, most of the American bombing operations have targeted the Iraqi resistance factions inside Syria, where they operate in coordination with the Syrian Arab Army. This explains the importance of the region for Washington, especially as it represents the soft loin that Daesh exploits to restore its activity. Hence, ladies and gents, behold the American Air Force being used again as Daesh ISIS Air Force simply to keep Syria destabilized. The Iraqi resistance factions have retaliated by launching about 12 attacks on American occupation bases in Iraq since last February. This will for sure represent real pressure for the Iraqi government to resolve the issue of the U.S. occupation as soon as possible before the ball of confrontation rolls and burns what is left of American interests on Iraqi soil. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The pace of escalation is rising day after day against American interests in Iraq at a time when Mustafa al-Qadhimi's government is preparing to enter the fourth round of the strategic dialogue, which will discuss a complete withdrawal of the American occupation forces, instead of scheduling the withdrawal as agreed upon in the third round held last April. Now, this shift in the Iraqi position came in light of the exchange of fire between the American occupation and the resistance factions, which began in June when an American raid targeted a camp belonging to the Hashd al-Shaabi on the border strip between Syria and Iraq. Meanwhile, the American embassy in Baghdad was then targeted hours after American interests in western Iraq and other areas in neighboring Syria were similarly bombed. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Mohammed Abed, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Mohammed. Now, by escalating these raids against the resistance factions in Iraq, the U.S. is venturing to tilt the Iraqi position decisively towards the full demand of a full withdrawal from Iraqi soil. Now, if the withdrawal is the ultimate goal for real for the American occupation, why are the Biden administration and the U.S. forces escalating their fire against the Iraqi resistance?
First of all, we have to take into account that the escalation came after the negotiations between the Iraqi government and the U.S. administration has led nowhere. So here we have a situation in which the Americans sometimes say they are withdrawing, sometimes they say they are preparing to have the training courses for the Iraqi armed forces and the Iraqi police, and etc. Other times you see them barricading in their embassy, which is a huge size of the land in Baghdad. So you cannot be sure about this issue that the Americans want to withdraw. Now, when you deal with a country as such, this means you are telling the people of this country that you are an occupation force, and consequently they are going to deal with you as such. So the Americans all the time are trying to portray the issue as that the Iranians are the Iranian-backed militias are targeting our interests and our bases in Iraq. If you note how much they pump this propaganda war in this regard, you will understand that people are tending to forget that the Americans are an occupation force in Iraq, and consequently they are going to be dealt with likewise, meaning mm-hmm. as an occupation force. So these are the main things that we need to take into account whenever we are tackling the issue. Now, you see that the Americans are getting a lot of strikes from the Iraqi resistance. We need to underline the word resistance because there's an occupation force, and consequently they cannot retaliate with the way that, for instance, Trump would have wanted. And even if Trump was there, and I mean the Trump administration, the American army would not and the American Navy would not agree to an escalation because they know about their weaknesses in Iraq. They know about their weaknesses that have come in the last decade in the region and in the whole world as in general.
Mr. Mohammed, what's very interesting is that since the beginning of this year, we have seen more than 50 attacks. One were actually said that happened by the U.S. administration. Others they were silent about, that targeted U.S. interests in Iraq, especially the U.S. embassy in Baghdad, the Iraqi military bases that house U.S. troops in them, and the Erbil airport as well. We all remember that. In attacks often always attributed to the Iraqi resistance forces. In the event these attacks just increase and continue targeting U.S. occupation forces in Iraq, how do you think that the Iraqi government will maneuver around this fact in the upcoming talks?
Well, you have to take into account the complications that Mr. Kazemi is facing. You know, the Kazemi is what sort of a figure that was chosen to be in the middle between all parties, and you cannot be such a person and such a politician when you have a very complicated situation as the one in the Middle East in general, and specifically in Iraq, between all these forces that are around you. I mean, the Islamic Republic of Iran neighboring you, and you have the American administration and American troops occupying Baghdad. You have the Saudis intervening from here or there. You have other Gulf countries also. So it's a very complicated situation. And you notice that the Iraqi government is trying to please everyone. Whenever an American strike takes place, they criticize, for instance, slightly. But when the resistance retaliates, they try to make the those who carried out the operation as people who are not known, etc. So they are in a very, very in a real dilemma in this regard, in order how to deal with issues, because the issues are going in a very fast pace, and they cannot deal with the situation because of all of its old complications.
Well, it should be noted there, Mr. Hamad, that since the Biden administration took the presidency in the U.S. At the beginning of this year, most of the American bombing campaigns have targeted the factions, Iraqi factions, Iraqi resistance inside Syria, where they coordinate with the Syrian Arab Army their operations there, because it is the perfect spot, the soft loin that Daesh, ISIS, usually exploits to try and restore its activity. How on earth does the world not condemn the U.S. basically being Daesh Air Force there? They are playing the role of protecting the area for ISIS to return to that area. How does the world just keep silent?
Well, the world is keeping silent because of the American hegemony over the media all over the world. And so the things are quite clear in this regard. I mean, even when you go back to the times when I know this has been reiterated a lot, the Trump declaration that it was Clinton who created Daesh, and on the issue of the scandal of the emails, etc. But still, the whole world knows, and even Iraqis sometimes had videotapes and footage of the American helicopters just withdrawing the ISIS militiamen from certain areas and moving them to other areas. So the whole world knows, but remains silent, as is the case with the Palestinian issue, which is completely a just cause, and the whole world is turning the blind eye to that, the Israeli massacres, and the situation in Lebanon with the American pressures and so that are starving people here. So all over the world you have right is right and wrong is wrong, and things are right clear. But unfortunately, the American administration is sort of terrorizing and bullying all the media and all over the world, and all the politicians all over the world. Some of them subdue to the pressure, others reject this, and consequently would be confronting the American interests and American plans. But unfortunately, most of the world is just subduing to these pressures by the Americans.
Well, the dilemma of the White House is that it sees maintaining a small, what they call a focused mission inside of Iraq and inside of Syria as well, a worthwhile alternative to a complete full withdrawal of their forces. Yet obviously the Iraqi resistance will not stop its fight back. They will always keep targeting the U.S. occupation forces as long as they remain there. And obviously we've seen similar attacks against their bases in Syria as well. How do you think the Iraqi resistance will receive a possible decision by the U.S. to relocate from Baghdad and maybe go forward northwards Kurdistan? How will they deal with that?
Well, I'm sure also the strategists of the... I'm not going only to talk about the Iraqi resistance here. I'm talking about the axis of resistance in the whole region is reading very clearly the strategic weaknesses that have grown up and grown in the as far as the American administration is concerned, in the whole region and in the whole world in general. We are talking about military-wise and economically and in many other domains. So you have to take into account all these things and regard disregard whatever the Americans are trying to spread in their propaganda and in their media about their aim to help and assist the poor Iraqi people. They are trying to assist us here in Lebanon, I mean, with besieging us and banning us from getting any necessities that we need to live as a people. So the Americans are doing one thing and on the one hand, and quite the opposite on the other, and while all the time claiming to be the force of good in the whole world, which is the utmost contrast of truth and
well, I want to thank difference. You very much, Mr. Mohammed Abed, political commentator, for joining us talk about the latest attacks against U.S. occupation forces in Iraq and possibly also in the future in Syria. Thank you very much for being with us. Now, please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about the life and the loss of a Palestinian leader in Damascus. Stay with us.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
A fighter. This is how Ahmed Jibril spent his stormy life, witnessing the smallest details of the Palestinian struggle ever since the Zionist gangs of the first settlers uprooted the pillars of his family home in the village of Yazur near Jaffa in 1948 when he was just 10 years old. Since then, Jibril finally chose to cover his face with the dust of Damascus after he had discovered the secrets of geography between Palestine and the Levant interior and learned the language of the water flowing towards the south with bullets and longing to return to the basil and lemon gardens in Yazur. Jibril was laid to rest in his beloved Damascus last week after decades of struggle for liberation that seems today closer than ever because of the thoughts and activism of the likes of late Ahmed Jibril. More in the following report.
On a sad day, July 7, 2021, a great Palestinian icon, Ahmed Jibril Abu Jihad, one of the founders of the contemporary Palestinian Revolution and the Palestine Liberation Organization, passed away in Damascus. With his departure, the Palestinian National Movement and the Palestinian people, as well as the Arab and Islamic nation and the free people of the world, lost a stubborn fighter who did not know despair nor submission. The idea of fighting for Palestine persisted over Jibril's purpose in life. Instead of pursuing higher education, he joined the Syrian army and moved to the military college in Cairo to graduate as a combat lieutenant. Jibril quickly used his knowledge in order to build a force of Fidayeen, fighters for Palestine, to revenge the taking of Palestine by illegal settlers and the Zionist occupation army. He contributed to the establishment of the Palestine Liberation Front and then the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Jibril's bias towards geography was a sufficient reason to establish the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command in 1968 and to separate from the Popular Front and before it from the Fatah movement and its leader Yasser Arafat. He instead chose an alliance with the late President Hafez al-Assad in 1970, an alliance that Jibril remained loyal to until he descended on Friday, July 7, under the soil of the cemetery of the martyrs in Yarmouk camp, south of Damascus. Throughout the years of conflict, the general command did not miss the fateful battles. From fighting at home in Palestine to confronting the enemy in Lebanon, Jibril planned, organized, led, and won most of the battles he fought. From the hotel war against the forces of the Lebanese front at that time, which was fought in Beirut with the support of the occupation army, to facing the 1982 invasion of Lebanon on most of the battlefronts, from the south to the coastal line to the capital and Hamdoun to the central Biqa, especially in the famous battles of Sultan Yaqub to the famous Mountain War, in which the general command and the Syrian artillery were involved with great influence, so the battle against the Lebanese forces militia was decided at the time. As for the icon of Jibril's achievements, it was the glider's operation in 1987, which aimed to reach an occupation camp in the Galilee using gliders launched from Lebanon. This military achievement was one of the reasons for the outbreak of the First Intifada that year, in which Jibril and the general command played a prominent role in fueling it and providing it with moral and material support. Ahmed Jibril excelled in everything. His deep political vision prompted him to root the general command's relations with the various resistance factions and parties that engaged in fighting, especially Hezbollah and the Syrian Social Nationalist Party, where they all carried out several joint operations. Ahmed Jibril did not leave his two sons, Jihad and Khalid, trust funds and palaces. Rather, they inherited a life project that ends with death solely for Palestine. Now, to discuss the life of this brave man with us from Damascus is Mr. Tahsin Al-Halabi, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Tahsin. Now, late Ahmed Jibril's bias towards geography was a sufficient reason to establish the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the General Command, in 1968. How do you view the contribution of late Jibril to the fight to liberate Palestine?
You know, in the beginning, Comrade Jibril, he vowed all his life for Palestine, for liberating Palestine. And he also vowed the lives of his four children for Palestine, for liberating Palestine. He lost one, Jihad, the oldest one, as a revenge from the Israeli occupation when they targeted him in Beirut on 2002 in Beirut, because they knew that he was the one that sent from the Sea of Beirut to Gaza lot of weapons and lot of explosives and rockets for the revolution, for the resistance of the Palestinian factions in Gaza. Mm-hmm. Jibril's legacy really is very rich, very also deep in the roots of this resistance. From the beginning, he found that there was no way but to go to the military academy on 1957 to Egypt. In the beginning, he volunteered to the Syrian army, and he made course for to be an officer, and then he requested to go to the Academy of Cairo in order to get more knowledge about guerrilla warfare, not for conventional armies and conventional weapons for armies. He went there in order to get the background of military activities, of military operations, and then he turned by himself to the knowledge of the expertise of the guerrilla warfare. For this reason, he was the one that graduated from the Academy of Egypt in the specialty of mines and engineering military positions and wireless also communications.
Well, Mr. Tahsin, in relation to the current events happening at the moment as we speak in occupied Palestine, how do you think the mental mull of Ahmed Jibril can affect the current wave of revolution against the occupation and also against the police state now cracking down on the Palestinian natives?
Jibril knew his road very well, and he knew the ways of how to confront the occupation forces. Therefore, when the Oslo Accord Accords was signed by PLO leadership and Israel, he was the one that called all the Palestinian masses inside occupied Palestine to protest, to be against such accords, and to try to make any way to go to the road of resistance. From that moment, he started to receive hundreds of Palestinian youth from West Bank and Gaza Strip in Damascus, in the headquarters of the PFLP General Command. And they were trained here for a few weeks or more than 2 months from Hamas and from Jihad Islami. Many young Palestinian individuals, Palestinian fidaeen, came here to his headquarters in Damascus, in Syria, and were getting all the making how of explosives, of weapons, of rockets, of lot of things, and so he made certain.
He embodied. He basically embodied the real resistance of the Palestinians
In front of them.
Mr. Tahsin Jibril believed that Palestine is an Arab issue, and he rejected all attempts to isolate it from its Arab depth because of his belief that the liberation of Palestine is an Arab task and not only a Palestinian task. Because the Zionist danger does not threaten the Palestinian people alone, it threatens all of us and even goes past the Arab world. Where do you see the current Arab position from all the new changes happening inside Palestine right now?
From the beginning, he knew very well that no faction alone or with other factions, with other Palestinian factions, can liberate Palestine by his own capabilities and military equipments and military activities. He knew that the Palestinian factions should be the spear of the Arab armies that will participate in any war against the occupation forces inside Palestine. He wanted that those factions to be the pioneers on the road of guerrilla war against the Israeli occupation, whether inside Palestine or across the borders, from Jordan, from the Golan Heights boundaries, from South Lebanon, from Gaza, from all those boundaries surrounding Palestine. He tried to prepare such activities and giving trainings, military trainings for hundreds of Palestinians in order to do that, but not believing at all that the only Palestinian factions can liberate Palestine. He needed the Arab armies surrounding Palestine, occupied Palestine, to participate and to share with this victorious war against
Mr. Tahsin Al-Halabi. Mr. Tahsin Al-Halabi, a political commentator, we celebrate today a man like Mr. Ahmed Jibril, and we celebrate men like you who have a great history in a struggle against the Zionist occupation on the road to the freedom of Palestine. Thank you very much for joining us from Damascus to celebrate with us this fallen hero. Thank you very much for being with us, and please stay tuned next week for more from our Middle East stream.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Back to Reality. In the studio with me, I have two special guests with whom I am totally stoked to have a very interesting and fiery discussion, inshallah ta'ala. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Gentlemen, would you introduce yourselves for the record?
I'm Muzaffar Haider from the UK.
I'm Hassanain from India.
Thank you for joining us on the show. Do y'all believe in miracles? A part of yu'minuna bil ghaib, as Allah says in the Quran, believing in the unseen, is believing in the miracles.
Miracles are things you see.
What? No. Miracles as in the miracle. Because this is what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
Miracles that he mentions in the Quran, that he performed for his prophets and his beloved people. And then...
Like the general miracles.
Yeah,
not just
and
the
then
miracles
like
of
the
prophets.
Miracle that we all know about as Muslims as a fact. Right?
Like Prophet Musa parted the sea.
The sea, exactly. Rasulullah parted the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Amir al-Mu'minin returned the sun. And stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
And whoop-de-doop, it's all good and great. Friends, your aunt, Bob's your uncle, so those miracles happen. And do you believe in anything beyond that? Let's say, how do you define miracle?
Like something which is not normal.
I'm not normal at all. I'm a total weirdo. No, really. See? Brother Muzaffar, what's a miracle to you?
Everything is a miracle to me, sister. Everything is a miracle to me. Everything is a miracle. Truly.
No, what does... Okay, the definitive...
The sun, the star, the moon, the existence
no,
on this planet. Everything is a miracle.
Right?
Okay, you know what? Actually,
and for a disbeliever, nothing is a miracle. Even if he sees Prophet Moses part the Red Sea, he will still look at it and go, this is just some sort of scientific, chaotic accident.
What sorcery is this?
Yeah.
You're actually legit right, because in the definitive definition of miracle, or ijaz, as it is referred to in Arabic, it means something... that cannot be replicated by human beings through human being resources. And literally, the universe, the sun, the moon, no, I don't think, like, if we try and if we, our scientists try till the end of time, they won't be able to produce anything like a fragment.
It says in the Quran, you won't be able to create a fly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You're right. If we're going to talk about the definition of miracle or ijaz, that is what
it
means.
You know,
oh, wait,
an act
like,
of
I think
God.
You know, everything is actually a miracle, but like if you look specifically what miracle is, like leaving apart the things which are normal, as you say, like the general things, like sun, it's a miracle, but sun every day it rises from the east and sets in the west.
So, and
the
also,
thing it's normal, we don't call it a miracle. It's something beyond that normal.
Okay, so this is what I'm trying to say. If we look at the definition of miracle, which means something that no human being has the power to replicate, then yes, the sun is a miracle, right?
But then so is a painting.
But then, no, I mean, if we have put all our resources together, I'm pretty sure we can, you know, train a person to draw Mona Lisa. But, here's the thing. Bro, you don't go, whoa, every time you see the sun.
No, that's because I'm just, like, not
used
alive,
to it.
Right?
Because you're used to it.
Yeah, I mean, if
so
even if you saw...
So that comes down to the fact that what Brother Hassanain said, it has to be extraordinary.
Not necessarily. Look, if you saw Prophet Musa every single day
parting
the Red
Sea,
eventually it would be like, oh, okay, it's not a miracle anymore. But that doesn't
mean
it's not
a miracle.
No, it's a miracle,
but you're desensitized.
You're desensitized
somehow.
To it, and we are desensitized to the miracle of existence.
Is it good or bad?
Very bad. Look at the brother, right? The people listening can hear his voice. Look at his existence. Look at our existence right now. Look at the words that we're speaking. This isn't real. This is a dream. Just wake up to it. Just realize that it is. We don't because we are desensitized to the reality of this miracle. But it is a perpetual miracle. We are living it. Yeah. But anyway, putting that aside for a moment, okay? According to our aqaid, like our scholars, they say that a miracle, even a miracle, such as Prophet Musa turning a staff into a snake or parting the ocean or fireballs from the sky or whatever it was, all of those miracles, they coincide with the physics of our reality. So even miracles, technically speaking, do not defy
physics.
The laws which have been written by Allah, the laws of physics and chemistry and mathematics, they don't defy that.
Brother Hassanain,
yeah.
Would you say that you've witnessed miracles in your life?
Yeah, like...
No, we're not talking about the general. The general miracle sort of everything is a miracle with that optimistic view, worldview kind of stance. Miracles like...
I would say, like, where works wouldn't have happened in the smooth way, but they have actually happened.
Give me an example.
That could be a miracle. Like, you know, like, 2 years ago, I wanted to go for Ziyarat.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, no one was able to go that time. No one was getting the visa, but I got the visa the same day, the same time. Then I was able to go for the Ziyarat.
That felt miraculous to you,
yeah.
Right? Well, Aba Abdullah does function very mysterious.
The Kabbalah, the whole Kabbalah is a miracle. Like, last year, you know, you see, like, millions of people Zaire.
Right. You believed in it, and therefore it's a miracle for you. However, other people or disbelievers, they'd be like, well, it's just a coincidence.
No, the Ziyarat of Karbala last year, I'm talking about last year, it's a miracle in itself. Like, people know, the world have seen that there were millions of Zaireen. There was no, like, any virus, nothing, no one, you know, got the COVID.
This is Back to Reality, and we are talking about, do y'all believe in miracles? We'll be back after a short break, so stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
You're listening to Back to Reality, and we're talking about, do y'all believe in miracles? Those who are, like, downright disbelievers, they believe even the universe is a coincidence.
Yeah, there you go.
It's kind of like... It doesn't matter what they think because everything is a coincidence to them anyway. First of all, I've never experienced any miracles in my own life.
But you believe in the past miracles,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and I only believe in that because God said so. I don't have any proof to back it up.
Mm-hmm.
Or any, like, logical prerequisite to demand a miracle in that situation.
I
think that's what miracles are all about. It's like when you want to defy logic.
Yes.
Right? Because they're not listening to reason anymore. Yes! That's what miracles are. When a person does not listen to reason anymore, Allah is like, bam! There you go. See something miraculous. Maybe then you'll believe that I'm awesome. And that's the case with a lot of the prophets.
What are the stories we hear from Mashhad?
Like, what about them?
People getting Shafa and all, like, from Baba Shafa.
What do you think the deal is with it, really?
Yeah, that is a miracle. Like, you know, someone blind, a blind man coming to the Zari for Ziyarat. Mm. Like, Imam giving Shafa to him.
Mm.
That is a miracle.
Why do you think the Imam gave him, cured him, healed his eyes? What made him so special? I mean, in the case of Fir'aun, we knew what was so special about him. He was Fir'aun, and he was slaughtering people and oppressing the rest. But with that random dude, that random blind layman that went to the Haram, why did Imam Rida alayhi salam just choose to heal his eyes?
You know, God asks us to pray, right? Like, make dua.
Mm.
So that's all, like, when you go and ask, your wish might be fulfilled. You know, there's actually a story for it. You know, there's, like, you know, there were a few Shias.
Mm.
They went and, you know, they made their wishes, and their wishes were not fulfilled.
Mm.
And there were a few, like, non-Muslims, some people, they went there and they made their duas and their wishes were fulfilled.
Mm.
So someone, you know, they asked them, like, what's the difference? Our wishes are not being fulfilled. And the non-Muslims, they came to the Haram, they prayed, and their wishes are fulfilled. Like, you know, there's a difference. You go and pray there, you know, and you have a hope that your wish might be fulfilled. But when they come to the Haram, they came just to, you know, test the Imam. Like, you know, they heard that there's someone in Mashhad, his grave, people go over there and their wishes are fulfilled.
You know, Allah only gives...
Yeah, I'm just trying to wrap my brain around this whole miracle ordeal. Sure, back then, in the case of a person like Fir'aun, Allah needed to, you know, Nabi Musa needed to pull out some things out of his sleeve, which he literally did. He pulled out his hand out of his sleeve and it was glowing.